Shaped by Sound combines performance and conversation to capture the depth of the North Carolina music scene. On the surface, MIPSO is a tight-knit bluegrass and Americana group forged by friendship at UNC Chapel Hill, along with countless hours of playing together on the road. But that's not the full picture of this group. In fact, when you zoom in past those genres, you get something much deeper, brilliant, and unique. Today on Shaped by Sound, performing songs from across their catalog and in conversation with me, this is MIPSO. I was doing a little internet sleuthing on both of you before you came in, just, you know, doing my research. Isaac and I were doing that, our story producer. And obviously we, you know, went through Wikipedia and I found something on there. It was about Little P and the Miso.
Mm.
Can we talk about that for a second?
Yeah. We should set the record straight on this one.
Yeah.
This is a 100% factual, very true story. And the story goes, we wanted a band name and we didn't want it to sound too overly folky because we felt like there were a lot of bands with similar names in those days. Maybe this is true in every era of music. And we learned about a phrase. We went to Japan early on and played a little bluegrass festival in Takarazuka, Japan, because Jacob did some research over there for his senior thesis.
Oh, cool.
The third oldest bluegrass festival in the world.
Whoa.
That's true.
Okay.
And a cool scene of like real bluegrass heads.
Mm-hmm.
We found that there's an old phrase that's like, you say, oh, there's a little P in the miso, which means like, you know, it's traditional. It's something I recognize, but there's something a little off.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought that was funny.
Yeah.
And so we put a little P in miso.
That's awesome.
There you go.
It's funny because I've had some people come up to me like, so MIPSO, where do you, like, what's the name? Where did that come from? And I was like, well, we found this thing on Wikipedia. I think it's we got to go to the primary source and figure it out.
Yeah. You know, the number of times you've been asked that question, we've been asked that question way more.
I'm sure you have.
But we brought it upon ourselves.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. I think that's a really fun name and it really makes a lot of sense for y'all too. So also kind of wanted to jump in and just, you know, so you're both from North Carolina. Can you talk to us a little bit about where you're from?
Yeah, I grew up in Morganton in the foothills and was there for a while until a fated day in Chapel Hill when I met my triad brother-to-be.
That's right. Ooh. Yeah, I grew up in High Point.
Mm-hmm.
And we met on a college visit trip to Carolina. We were like, I guess 18.
Yep.
In the spring of
2008.
2008. And we this is the funny part looking back to me is that we both had our instruments. We were visiting college together and for the like 2-day weekend trip, Jacob took his mandolin and I took my guitar. And
That's
we were
awesome.
Like, hey, you want to meet in the courtyard and play some songs?
Yep. Much more interested in talking about songs than talking about the potential future at school. And talking about songs became our potential future at school.
Yes, yeah, sure.
That's so cool. And so this is even like before orientation. This is like you just were in high school and went to go visit and you were like, this is it. This is my moment. I need to bring my instrument.
You'd never leave home without it.
And sometimes you find your bandmate.
That's, yeah, if you're lucky.
Yeah, little did we know. It is funny.
Yeah. So that's sort of where this like journey for you all begins, right? What was that like as you like found each other? Like, what was that moment like and kind of how did it evolve?
Well, that was a time in the wider and the North Carolina music scene where there was a real boon in the acoustic music community presenting songs less traditionally. Mumford, the Avets, a lot of people were kind of for the first time, I think, combining some of the song craft that we found appealing about other music with the roots of the music that we had grown up around.
Right.
And so what we were thinking when we first met each other was just, what could our version of that be? Mm-hmm. And how do you write a song? How do you perform it? And I think that quest is really what led up the start of our relationship and led us to Wood and Libby as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were super green. I mean, we were kids who wanted to learn how to play music together and really wanted to learn how to sing together. And I think that's what kind of like gelled our interest in continuing to make something together, me and Jake, is that first time we played together, we sang some harmonies and it was fun and also felt sort of natural.
Yeah, and we would play like a coffee house, Jack's Brat.
Jack's Brat.
R.I.P. on Franklin Street. That was our first gig as a duo. And then Joseph met Wood through a mutual friend.
Yeah, one of my high school buddies. And Libby, I met at a party in Carrboro. She dated my brother for a long time.
Nice.
So she was just sort of like one of our best friends. And we were just friends making music. There was no grand design of like, we're gonna plot a great folk band.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was just, how do you do this? That we've always loved.
Yeah.
I think we were all fascinated with bands.
Yeah.
Had grown up around you know, within families that whether they played music or not made a lot of space for music. Mm-hmm. And so we were kind of obsessed with like different groups and different groups for each of us, different types of groups. And we wanted to figure out how do you do that? Not because we thought we would actually be doing it 15 years later, but it just seemed like a fun basis for friendship.
Right.
And we got asked to play a show and we actually have a recording of it, that first one. And it was so bad. You can't believe how green we were.
Yeah.
But it's kind of cute. Like we were earnest and having fun and people were, I think, were having fun around it. People who were hearing it. We were not the focus of the gig in a lot of ways.
No, it wasn't a gig. It was a party with music.
Exactly. But we got it got us excited and it kind of lit this little fire of how can you keep doing this? How can you do it more? And to do it more, you have to do it a little bit better. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of the basis for our friendship.
I think also our second gig was also like a sort of like party fundraiser for something for a fraternity.
Uh-huh.
And
y'all got asked to do a fundraiser on the second gig.
That was gig one.
Oh, that was gig one?
Yeah.
I'm talking about the oyster roast. Remember they did like a big oyster roast and we played in the corner unamplified and it was like, we might as well have an excuse to play. And they handed us an envelope with $200 in it. And to record our first EP, we took it to one of my buddies who had a bunch of microphones and we didn't even open the envelope. We were like, we think there's $200 in here.
Yeah.
Is this enough? Can you help us?
Like a mafia deal or something.
it was very low key.
Yeah. But so what did you all find? Like what was clicking? Like what were the things that you were like, well, it was working, like that you were like, wow, this could really be something.
I think Joe's right. It was harmony first. Mm-hmm. That I think was the first thing that we were, whether it was like working or not, it was the first thing that we found our unique version of. Mm. That feels like from the earliest recordings and since, that's been like the most common thread, I would say.
Yeah. It's the question of what's fun enough to help keep you interested in it, to do it for a lot longer.
Right.
Because the only way to get better at something, I think, is to do it for a long time. We've done this for a long time. When we started, we were not good at all, but we just had such a fun time singing together. We were like, this is worth continuing.
Mm-hmm. And it seemed like at the time you all were just becoming students of music then, right? Sort of like self-taught, but still like really trying to study and figure out and work together. Just as you would in any sort of undergrad, I feel like you were just doing that, but with each other and maybe the larger music scene.
Yeah. I mean, all my bandmates did take some music classes, though that wasn't the academic focus. But yeah, I feel like MIPSO was my musical education. Like we taught each other how to do so many parts of what we do now.
Yeah, totally. And it was a great education in the like personalities that make up this part of the state and the country that make this such an incredible place to make music.
Yeah.
We started meeting old folks. Like I would go down to Pittsburgh and hang out with Tommy Edwards, who's this incredible old guitar player, and would sit in his antique shop and he would flip the open sign to say close. And he would lock the door and sit down with me and say, let's play some tunes. Mm. It was an education face-to-face, person-to-person. And that's a cool way to learn something.
Yeah. Do you think that music can sort of provide a sense of place in a way? Like, specifically what you're saying, right? Like this time and this age and sort of like what you came from sort of helped develop this sense that was just, this is North Carolinian music. Do you think that's accurate?
Oh yeah. I mean, I think especially in the years since, as the culture and community has changed so much, the thing in Central North Carolina and beyond, the thing that I feel most bound to as a North Carolinian with identity is the musical core. Mm. That's what I feel like we share and that no level of politics can change.
Yeah. What do you think, Joe?
Definitely. And I wonder too about like, even like the landscape itself, like this actual place that we live in was a part of what helped this music develop. I mean, not to get back into like, it's the combination of like descendants of slavery and like people who came from Ireland and England and brought ballads over, but like people who were in mountain communities really isolated from each other, taking these traditions and keeping them going. Mm-hmm. And not because they were like beholden to tradition or because they had some like abstract stake in continuing something. They loved these things.
Yeah.
And they meant something and they told stories. It was a way of telling stories with melodies. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, in the early 20th centuries, they moved to mill towns. And all these different people from different communities were working together in these mill towns and this sort of like new resurgence of a kind of like string band thing was happening here. I don't know. It happened here and it's still here. And I think that it's like you say, everywhere you turn, there's old folks who've been carrying these songs for a long time. So
yeah. And if you hear that song and you could be anywhere else, be like, that reminds me of North Carolina or this time and place or being in college with, you know, my buddies and figuring out music for the first time.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Totally really proud to be associated with the North Carolina music scene very much.
Yeah. So talk to me a little bit about how this started to evolve, right? At what point was there, so like you meet Libby and Libby comes in and you're, you know, there's four of you. And at what point were you like, this is something we want to get on the road with. Like I want to tour and I want to like try and really make this happen.
Yeah. Well, graduation put a real cliff to our, you know, comfy, cozy, do whatever you want with your weekends time as college students.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we had to decide.
It kind of built from that first gig to over those next 2.5 years. It was at first like one weekend a month and then every other weekend. And then basically every weekend we were playing shows wherever we could get a booking across North Carolina.
Yeah.
And we would come back to Chapel Hill for these kind of like once a semester banger shows at the Cradle is how it felt. Where it was like, we didn't know what to do with ourselves that many people were coming. We would literally be like cramming the days before of how do you put together a full set for this many people?
Yeah.
And we would look for ways to make it more exciting than just us two. Like we had a mariachi band march through the crowd in between the openers at the second Cradle show. And we would find older musicians who we admired and try and convince them to open for us that we could kind of like have that side stage experience of learning from their craft. And so we were getting all these peaks of ways that you could do it. I don't know if professionally is the right word, but with maybe even more long-term intention. Mm-hmm. And then as graduation approached, we thought, how cool would it be to do this for a year, to be able to make a record like we've been listening to and like we've heard about, and to have that time and space and to pay for it by playing some shows. And the first gigs we really could get were ironically in Japan, to your opening question, because I had come back from a summer of research there and knew a lot of the promoters. So we went thinking this will just be a cool experience and we'll come back, we'll finish this record, we'll tour it, and then we'll probably get jobs or do something. And we made a documentary with a friend of ours, John Casby, another North Carolinian who's become a celebrated documentary maker since. And that film started doing well at the independent film festival circuit. Mm. And that was really the first thing that kind of people within the industry started to reach out to us. And we saw these inklings of, oh, there might be a path here beyond this year of fun that we thought was all it would be.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of it's flukes of timing. I mean, I think that the most honest way to tell our story is to not give ourselves much credit. I mean, we've gotten very lucky at these sort of key moments. And it was at the very beginning of streaming, which, you know, is such a double-edged sword. A lot more people have heard about us. It's also, I don't think, a very positive way forward for the music industry at large, which is sort of easy to see and another topic. But we put out a record that we really worked hard on, and we got a bunch of buddies to help us with, Andrew Marlin from Watch House and the Chatham County Lion guys, and Bobby Britt from Town Mountain. A lot of these great, cool musicians who we looked up to that were very much a part of the North Carolina sound as we understood it.
Right.
And we made this album called Dark Holler Pop in a great studio called The Rubber Room in Chapel Hill. And we started playing, we were just playing coffee shop gigs, and it was a big deal for us when we went to like Greenville or like, you know, Columbia, South Carolina, maybe Charlottesville. Like we were just barely kind of like getting outside North Carolina. And about 6 months after the record came out, you know, we played a 15-person coffee shop show at some place. And then we went back to there 6 months later and there were like 65 people singing along to work. And we were like, I don't understand how this happened.
Yeah.
Like what's the, like we were grassroots. We were understanding, you know, every time you go back, you get the word out. You do college radio, you put up more posters. And right now it feels like a very like antiquated, old fashioned version of the music industry that we looked up to these bands that were made in the 90s and that's how they did it. And,
right.
And it was cool. But this was something that was different. And it was like, you know, virality was happening. And we learned that we had gotten some attention on Spotify, which none of us even used yet.
Right.
And so I think once we started to see like more people at shows outside of Chapel Hill, we were like, maybe this isn't just a year of fun. Mm. Maybe we should keep trying to take this seriously.
Yeah. What was it like? I feel like that must have been just like, there must have been so much energy behind that when you go into a room and there's all these new people and all of a sudden like everything's starting to change a lot faster, right? How did you sort of ride that energy? Like, how did you kind of continue forward from there?
We just said yes to everything.
Yeah.
I mean, that lesson learned would have been to put a filter on a little sooner, maybe. But we just kept going. And one of the things I will take credit for, because Joe's right, that a lot of it was this kind of random timing, right place, right time, right people around us who were lifting us up. But one thing that we did do well was we four just banded together and said, let's just give this everything as long as we can. And it's the most like defining struggle and achievement of the band is keeping four people whose lives were changing, whose musical tastes were changing, aligned enough to keep saying yes to each other. And I think that was why it worked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was
through our 20s.
But we felt all this pressure too of, as soon as some attention started coming, I think we felt a desire to really like put our stamp in a specific way and to craft that. And sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. I mean, I think the records always sounded good, but sometimes after the fact, we would be like, oh, that felt a little forced. What's our version of it? And we would find on stage then our version again, and that would inform the next record.
Whoa. So you were like workshopping things on stage.
Totally. I think in some ways we did things out of order. Like we had a lot of musicians you think of as like, okay, they workshop for years. They're in training and then they study with the teacher and eventually they reach a point where they're being on stage more often. We got an opportunity kind of, you know, backwards from that to be on stage a whole lot as we were learning to play music. And I mean, I think it's cool. It can make it difficult because you're like, you're getting like audience validation and that can be like mixed up with personal artistic pursuit validation.
Interesting.
But we also got like a lot of, I think that the only way to be comfortable on stage is to just be on stage for more time. Mm-hmm. And we spent a lot of time on stage. And also like that's a really deliberate and intense way of getting to know each other musically.
Right.
So we've really formed like a band sound in a way that I don't think happens when you're like casually playing together in spare time.
Yeah. Y'all were putting in your 10,000 hours.
Yeah, as a group.
Right.
Yeah, and individually, yeah. Mm.
But mainly on stage. I mean, that's how we thought of ourselves at the time as a touring band.
Right.
We were living in the same house. Which was kind of irrelevant because really we were living in the same van. We would be gone for between 250 and 300 days a year and we'd play four or five nights a week in those early days. And it started to change quickly how our DNA almost like fused.
Yeah. And you must have really liked each other to spend that much time together. Or maybe not.
I mean, yeah, we did.
We did it first.
Yeah.
It's very sibling-like.
Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Somewhere between polygamous marriage and being siblings.
But it must have been really interesting because I feel like at that time too, you were bringing a lot of people into this bluegrass Americana tent that maybe hadn't been there before. Do you feel like you were doing that as you were touring and getting this music out there again at the beginning of streaming? I mean, it seemed like you were striking at a very interesting time with that genre of music.
Kind of unbeknownst to us.
Yeah.
You know, the records were classified as bluegrass records by Billboard, which was helpful to us because we could kind of have an outsized impact in that small pond.
Right.
But then we would go to the bluegrass festivals and we were the least bluegrass band there.
Yeah.
And we kind of liked that idea of being a gateway drug between the two communities, bringing younger fans who maybe were less familiar to that more traditional community and bringing traditional fans into a more, not pop, but like popular music space. Right.
That's the little P in the miso.
There you go. Yeah, one of my uncles is two of my uncles are great banjo players. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to one of them, Hugh, at the time and was like, hey, Hugh, why do you keep playing banjo for years and years? And was really active touring in the 70s. And I was like, why do you think there's such a resurgence of, to me, this was like a new thing in 2012. Like, we were like obsessed with the Punch Brothers or whatever. Why is there such a resurgence in this kind of like bluegrass music? And he was like, I don't see a resurgence. It's been here all along.
Right.
And maybe that's part of the distinction of like being from here. If it's part of the like the infrastructure, the personality, like the architecture of the people that make up this place. Mm-hmm. And so we were lucky to be here and had a lot of people that could really show us the way. But I do think if you weren't familiar with that stuff, maybe we were like showing it to some people for the first time.
Yeah. Everybody in the band can sing and harmonize and you all write songs. What's that like? Like, what's the dynamic like for you all? As you're thinking about a record and you're out there workshopping things, like, how does that work together?
It's changed for each record.
Yeah.
How it is that we've approached and found that alchemy. But it generally starts with the same question, which is what are we all excited about individually? And what's the overlap there? From songs that we've been writing on our own, ideas we've been throwing around together, to move away from song form just to like types of groove, types of sounds. Mm. That was kind of generally like the first question ahead of a new record. Sure. And we would use both that answer and then also a lot of it was just what was practical. You know, there were times where we had very little money and very little time to make a record. And so we didn't have the luxury of space to determine it. It was like, okay, we got 10 days between these two tours. We need a day off and then we're going to make a record. So it has changed each time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think part of our secret formula has been never coming up with a formula. In other words, we sit with each other with like broad, vague possibility of all the different albums you can make for as long as it takes for one to emerge. And that means that it's different every time we get together because we're different people every time we get together. Mm-hmm. But it was resisting a type of record that we make that kept us feeling like we could make something fresh and new. It's difficult because we're all four. I think bands have a sort of like central point either in the songwriting or the singing that other musicians can wrap their sound around. Mm-hmm. And without that, I think that the challenge for us has always been, how do you keep multiple voices and multiple musical sort of like, you know, fabrics to weave together without seeming like a songwriter in the round? We're not just taking turns.
Yeah.
We have different singers, but one sound. Mm.
The Book of Fools, the most recent studio record, that process is one I'm really proud of, separate from the record itself.
Yeah.
It was the first time we really had time to get together and let songs change. And we started out, we were mainly in North Carolina for those writing sessions. And we would kind of like in a round show off different things that we had been working on. And sometimes it was a full song. Sometimes it was just a line. Sometimes it was a couple bars of a groove. And we would see what connected with somebody else. And if it did, we had the time to workshop it then together and to see what could build. And that was one of the few times that we really had enough space and the luxury of time to water things and see how they could grow together, which was really fun.
Yeah, we started with like 50 songs.
Yeah.
Wow.
Or 50 ideas, you know, like 35 of which were like full songs.
50 seeds.
Yeah.
Some of which were, I mean, a lot of which were full songs that didn't make it.
We could have made tons of different types of records from that batch.
And from that batch, it wasn't like, what are the best songs? It was, what's a group that feels like they're telling a cool story together?
Yeah.
And that's kind of how we think of ourselves as a band too. How is it that we can tell a unique story? Not what's the best, but what's the thing that only these four people in this room would be able to do?
Yeah. I'm wondering, like, what do you think that story is now?
That's why we're filming this special, so everyone can see for themselves.
Yes.
Yeah, what's the story? The latest chapter of the thing we've been building. It's really funny because we're in our like early 30s.
Yeah.
I guess you can say early 30s until you turn 35, then you're mid 30s.
Yeah, I'm solid mid.
Jacob's mid 30s.
I'm solid mid too, so we're all there.
And we've been doing this together almost 12 years.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's interesting. I think we often think of our stories based on album cycles. Mm-hmm. And right now we have an album that's coming out in a week that's a live album.
Right.
And it's cool. It's so different than a studio album because often on studio albums, when the music is all done, we've had these disappointing experiences with the industry where they're like, okay, what's the story? And we're like, well, the songs are the story.
Yeah.
They're like, okay, well, yeah, but did anybody have a problem? Like, was there a car crash? Someone addicted to drugs? Was there a breakup? And we're like, no, it's just the music. And this has been a refreshingly different thing because the story is who we are as a live band, which is what we felt like the most all along.
Right.
And with the songs that we picked and the performances we picked, we wanted to, for the first time, tell the full story together. Not just what's new, but what's new about what's old too. We have our oldest and our newest songs on this record.
Yeah.
And we think they make sense together.
Yeah. And again, the album is called Gas in the Tank, Live Across America 2324, which feels sort of like a Grateful Dead sort of thing, which is cool. nailed it. What were you trying to capture with the live record? I know you kind of talked about it a little bit, but as far as like going through the songs and curating the songs, like what was the thought process there? Like, what were you trying to catch with that?
We found that during tours, the shows that feel most special happen without your awareness of it, happen sometimes catch you off guard. Mm. And it has to do with like the crowd being in the right headspace, the right people really like listening and being present, and us being in the right kind of like state of mind to like let something happen. And so we had a lot of shows that were, you know, big and important, and we're playing New York City for the most people we've played or whatever it may be. Mm. And it feels like, you know, we were like excited when we walked off stage, but we recorded all these shows. And when we went back and listened, sometimes those shows were like, they were fine. Mm. We didn't hit any wrong notes.
Yeah.
But they didn't feel like something was sparkling. Like nothing was like happening. Nothing was like emerging from the stage. Mm. And so I feel like it was the goal was to pick the performances. And it's funny you said the Dead, because like we are, I would say closet Deadheads, but I'm not ashamed of it. Have been for a long time. And Europe 72 is kind of an inspiration, being like, it's a live album that reflects them on stage, but it's culled from many different shows over the course of a tour, and they pick the best performances. Mm-hmm. And they actually re-recorded a lot of stuff. We didn't do that.
Yeah.
So we were picking performances that, like, there was one show on a Sunday night in Sacramento, California, where it wasn't even that big. But there was something about that California air. I don't know what it was.
Man.
In fact, the show was so, it was in this like.
It was loosey-goosey.
Yeah, it was in this country, almost like dive bar type of venue.
Yeah, saloon.
Saloon. Kind of. And they were like open, in a horrible decision for the quality of the music that you're hearing, there were open windows in the wall between the venue side and the bar side. So you could hear a lot of clatter from the other room.
Yeah.
But it created this atmosphere that was just kind of perfect. And the venue had even, that night, we learned that they had sold a lot of tickets with the wrong date on it.
Oh, so no.
It was, a lot of people who bought tickets weren't there because they thought it was happening the next night, which we learned the next morning when we got lots of angry emails as people were seeing our Instagram stories of like, wait.
What? Yeah.
But it there was just something about the show, and we were super gassed. This was the final week of the final leg of a long tour. And we kind of walked in and we're like, this pretty unremarkable room. I think we all, on a Sunday night, we're like, this will be fine.
Yeah.
And in the context of a band that's played 1300 shows, sometimes playing a fine show is a huge accomplishment.
Yeah.
But, and so it wasn't a bad thing. We're just like, we're kind of settling in, feeling super casual. And I definitely did not think one of those songs would make it to the record, but it's one of my favorite ones. Actually, that's the one that's coming out on Friday.
Yeah, it's the second single. Yeah. Mm. And so it's one of our first songs we recorded from our first record. Mm. That's sort of like a beautiful piano ballad Jacob sings called Do You Want Me? Mm. And we turn it into kind of like a honky-tonk country rocker.
Yeah, and Let Your Hair Down a little bit.
Let Our Hair Down a little bit, yeah.
There was a new band member that night that I got to meet, and I'll never forget him. His name's Sacramento Joe. And you'll hear him prominently on that song.
All right.
Yeah.
Sacramento Joe, gosh. Oof. Sounds straight out of a honky tonk.
Makes you want to take a little trip to Sacramento.
Yeah. Let my hair down too. What brings you joy playing together live?
I always feel like it's the sense that we're making something that none of us could make on our own. That there's something like mysteriously additive happening. And when we all play together, it's this kind of like, you know, three-dimensional being that we create that isn't something we could even imagine by ourselves. Mm.
That's awesome. What about you, Jacob?
I've been thinking a lot lately about, as our lives are changing, what a gift it is to be able to make music at all, to be able to make art in a world that often doesn't encourage you to do it. And that we've been given that gift so consistently for so many years and with each other. I feel like it's a gift we've given to each other also. I can't help but now be very present of that whenever we're making music together, and especially on stage. And you think of it, or I think of it, almost like a family reunion every time. And you see things in your family that no one else can see, mm-hmm. the good and the bad. And you have a level of comfort with yourself, with your family, that you don't have anywhere else.
Right.
And that's what this band has become. And that's an incredibly joyful thing.
Mm. It just from somebody on the outside and seeing you all release these dates here in North Carolina, it just felt like a homecoming sort of that we get to be a part of, which is really cool. I wanted to talk to you about the single microphone technique. And y'all use this in your shows, right? I feel like it's a traditional bluegrass Americana thing to do. And it sort of promotes togetherness, harmonies, and solos. Do you think that is a technique that just really fits what you all do? Is that, it feels like a MIPSO thing, beyond just it being a traditional thing, but specifically for y'all.
Yeah, I'm glad you see it that way. That's what it feels like. It it forces us to listen to each other in a different way. And oftentimes on stage, you're in your different zones with different monitors. And that's a moment where we get together and it's kind of like stripping things back to the core of what we do, which is listening to each other and listening to our acoustic instruments. And I also love that, like, speaking of like being shaped by sound, when you play a concert, what you're hearing in the audience is oftentimes as many as like 36 different individual audio inputs being gelled together. And in that moment, there's literally one thing happening. And it might be a combination of four voices, and it might be a combination of four voices and four instruments, but it's coming through one single source. So there's this like real true gelling of a combination of things that's actually being presented. You're not hearing a summed, you know, combination, but like the thing itself.
Right. There's so much less engineering on the other side, but there's engineering from you all, right?
Yeah.
It's also, initially when we started using it, it was closest to how we practiced too. Mm. So there's a part of it where that's how we were most comfortable playing music together, was in tight proximity.
Yeah.
And then since then, it's become a part of how, to Joseph's point, how we kind of like regain control both of ourselves and often of crowds within a show. Because there's this real tightening that happens when you ask people to do something with you.
Right.
And at that moment within a show, especially, we're asking them to kind of refocus. And it's a wonderful part of being at a show that you get to have moments where you're really dialed in and moments where there's lots of other stuff going on too. And we celebrate that. But there always is something nice about saying like, let's be still with each other for a moment here.
Yeah. There's a particular energy like in the audience that you can just like feel.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
Yeah. And kind of going back to this shape by sound idea, I'd like to ask you all, you know, how do you believe that you are shaped by sound?
You know, we've been talking about how music is from a place. And I very much feel like I'm from a place. I couldn't be me without having grown up here. But the first thing I thought of when you asked that was the cicadas. Mm. And this brood that hatched this past summer that sounded like an alien spacecraft hovering about a football field away, no matter where you were standing,
there was just gnarly. This
electric, but organic, weird buzzing. It took me back in this wildly visceral way to one summer when I was like 11 or 12. And I remember just being fascinated with finding these shells on all the little trees. And that was the soundtrack to it. Mm. And I don't know, it was a good reminder that sound, like on like a sort of like mechanical vibration level, is a little like laser beam to the unconscious. Mm. And I don't understand why. Yeah. I couldn't devote myself to something that wasn't on some level a mystery to me. Mm. And that is wild. I was like, I'm 33. And it was like, boom, there I was back, 2002, Randolph County, North Carolina, from sound.
Yeah. That's incredible. Jacob, do you have a response?
Yeah, for me, it's funny. Now, I've lived out of North Carolina for a number of years in a row now, and yet my identity in all those places is varied as like the North Carolinian. And so, especially post-Helene, a lot of people who aren't from North Carolina have been checking in. How's your community? How are things? And I've been processing what it feels like having grown up in the mountains to see all these places that were, from a landscape visual perspective, the like back pocket things in my mind fundamentally changed. And you know, for a generation, they'll look differently to other people than they look to me in my childhood. But the one thing that I've been reflecting that won't change is the sounds, both of the natural landscape and the type of music and the way people share music. And that is like a part of my core identity as a Western North Carolinian, is that music is something that you share, that you make with people, and that you use to share in this revelation that you feel some of the same things. You feel them differently, but you feel them the same way. And that to me is how I feel shaped, is that it encouraged me to really try and understand why I was feeling a certain way and how I could say that. And the first place I knew how to say those things publicly was through song. Mm.
That's awesome. I'd like to ask you all, like, what is your approach to a set list? Because they're different, right?
Oh boy. It's a good thing we got some battery power. We can talk about set list creation.
Can you actually grab the live record?
Yeah.
We write a different set list every night. And it was so much fun to make the live record, which is a combination of recordings from every different show we recorded.
Yeah.
But we made it like a set list, and this is what we have. Every show we write out with Sharpie the set list for that night, and we do it. We've never done the same one twice. Mm. And it's really funny because like you'd think having done something 1200 times, you'd have like a real science to it. And sometimes we think we're going to nail it and like, well, you know, that one didn't really hit tonight. And I think that the transition between this and this one wasn't quite right. But it's just like the most fun way to do it. And the only way to keep it feeling like for us, like something's happening on stage rather than we're just performing a road thing.
Right.
And we like it to happen after sound check and often right before we go on set. You want to know, you want the room, the crowd, our energies to help inform the route we're taking.
Yeah.
Well, we have, so it's always different, but we have some familiar patterns.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you want to, we thought a lot about how like the arc of it.
Yeah.
You know, what
from an emotional and energy perspective.
Yeah. Like what grabs somebody at the beginning, what things go well into and out of each other. And also sometimes the kind of like really stark juxtapositions that can feel really kind of surprising. And having the moment in the middle where we gather around a single mic is super fun to play with that too.
Yeah. I bet.
Know, the dynamics is cool. You know, yeah. we go real small and intimate, and then we can go big back. And
do you think there'll ever be a time where you'll go out with no set list and just completely wing it?
That would be cool.
Maybe.
Jacob's like, absolutely not.
it's interesting. We would do it. I think we would do it well.
Yeah.
But I don't know. There's certain types of things that I like as a, sometimes it's like what tickles me as a performer and sometimes it's what tickles me as a concert goer. Mm. And I don't always love to see a band talking on stage.
Yeah.
And to themselves. And I wonder, I'm thinking about the logistics of would we be able to pull that off?
We discuss things, you know, we're like a very like discursive band and it's not like, I can imagine maybe like, I don't want to be up there and be like, now, this is this. I don't, you know.
Yeah.
Drill sergeanting it. So I think, maybe it wouldn't work as well for us. Mm. Also, it's nice to turn off that part of your brain when you're playing. I know what's happening next. I can just play this song.
Right.
I'd be starting about halfway through a song to be like, what's next?
Yeah,
what's
that's
next?
True.
Yeah.
And then you're distracted.
And you're worried about it. Yeah. I'm going to put this up real quick. Yeah, sorry, I asked you just because in the vein of Grateful Dead, right? They just went up there and just did it some nights, which isn't, I don't know how they do that, but yeah, I think you can tell when they're just like, yeah, maybe we'll do this one.
Yeah. Often bands, I think that a part of the beauty of our band for me is that we don't kind of to Joe's earlier point, we don't have like one central thing that other people are falling behind.
Yeah.
I think that it would be easier in a band where there was a clear front, one person who's singing all the songs.
And yeah.
I could imagine that version of not making a set list easier than the multi-headed beast that we are.
Right. Right. So maybe we jump back into your set list for the show today and kind of walk through those. I've got a list of them here, so I'll kind of just walk through them. The first one is Edges Run.
Edges Run is a song that is also an album title. It's an album we made in Oregon. Mm. The album we made furthest from home. And that album feels very indicative of that place and time. It was right after the first Trump inauguration. Mm. It was winter on the Oregon coast. And we were interpersonally at a low point, I think, as a band. And a lot of the songs really benefited from that struggle. Mm. And Edges Run is one of my favorites from that session.
Yeah, check out Wood's bass line on this one. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite like sleeper classic Wood Robinson moments.
Yeah.
This sort of like very odd motif that continues under the chord changes that really makes the whole song for me.
Mm, cool. What about Carolina Rolling By?
It sure does roll by, doesn't it?
Dang, yeah.
Carolina Rolling By is from our most recent record, Book of Fools. And that song came from a canoe accident. Mm. I had the misfortune of falling out of a canoe on Jordan Lake, actually on New Hope Creek right off Jordan Lake, onto a tree root that I didn't know was there. And they thought that I had a spinal injury because very quickly I couldn't move. And then they thought it was maybe a cracked kidney, but it turns out it was just a torn muscle that touched my spinal cord there at the base of my back. So I spent about 2 weeks not being able to walk or move very much. I learned that back injuries can be very serious.
Yeah.
And I learned that canoes, while very peaceful, lovely leisure craft, can also be very dangerous.
Yeah, temperamental, huh?
Yeah.
That's how I describe you too.
Thank you. I'm a dangerous leisure craft. But I was on some high dosage serious pain meds for a few days there, and it got me in the right mindset to write this little story about a guy driving a truck who's addicted to pills, but he's still got the hope that he can, you know, turn his life back around.
Mm. And what about People Change?
People Change, also from that Oregon session. That's a song that I feel we inhabit really well on stage. And that song, though I love the recording, to me really came into its own once we figured it out on stage about 6 months after that album came out. I think there's a real calmness and confidence in how that song starts so delicately and burns to a simmer.
Yeah. What's it like for y'all to just, for that one maybe in particular here, to revisit? Because it's, I feel like singing it now might mean something. Does it mean the same thing or does it mean something different from when you first wrote it?
I think it, I've learned that that song means many different things to many different people.
Yeah.
And it has had multiple meanings for me, mm-hmm. for sure. My perspective on it has shifted. And I think that in the performance, vocally, it feels like it's a different song to me now than it was.
Mm. Yeah, the reason I brought that up is because you really do mention the time passing in that one. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah, a more accurate rewrite would add a couple years to that
yeah.
first line.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
What about the numbers?
Yeah, I love that. The numbers has such a cool attitude, and I love playing that one. It's a little bit of us kind of like getting into a slinky, vibey surf rock territory. Mm-hmm. But it's a really cool satire that Libby wrote, which I think of as being like sort of like a takedown of the like Kai Riz doll version of like, how are you feeling? Well, that's probably based on how the economy's doing. How's the economy doing? Well, let's just check the stats. You know, a very like simplistic and reductive version of understanding anything.
Yeah.
Let alone like the health of a people.
Mm-hmm.
A great song for me too to highlight, you know, Mipso is us four, but we've been really shaped by some long-term band members who've been with us on the road. First, Jan Westerlin, who's mm-hmm. a Durham bass musician, and now Sean Trischka on drums. Core part of how we and our sounds have changed over the years, but also the producers we've brought for each record. Mm-hmm. And Book of Fools was produced by a longtime friend of ours, Shane Leonard. And I feel like Shane,
yeah,
both in the box and then in post too, really, that song became something totally different than I thought it was going to be based on like those early sessions in the yeah. mountains writing it or hearing it from Libby.
Totally.
What did you think it was going to be at first?
I thought it was going to be a kind of stripped back, simmering Libby song,
mm-hmm.
like a classic version of Libby vocally and performance. And it went way more into a like finger wagging swag than I was expecting.
Hmm. Cool.
Very different, a similar strength of attitude, but a really different personification of it.
Yeah. What about Called Out Loaded?
Speaking of letting your hair down, I feel like Called Out Load is a real Jacob Sharp letting his hair down moment.
Mm.
Joseph Terrell on guitar too. One of my favorite electric guitar moments of you on record.
I do play guitar on that one.
Yeah, Called Out Loaded. I think that's a song that at this point it's more important to me for what it represents within a set than what it's about as a song.
Yeah.
And within a set, it really is us kind of letting one fly.
Mm-hmm. You do kind of just like really change up the vibe there with that, right? It's all of a sudden it's a rocker.
Yep.
Yeah. I get to have a fuzz pedal on my pedal board for just one song. I also want to be like, ladies and gentlemen, the same man that sings People Change, Called Out Loaded. Here we go.
And Big Star.
Big Star is one of my favorite Libby tunes for sure. It's a really simple song about going to the beach with a friend and finding love by looking at them.
Mm-hmm.
But also as a band, it was a really cool moment for me. It's one of my favorite recordings from our 2020 record, just called Mipso, where we let ourselves really strip back the traditional thing that we've done of you know, each playing a role we expect to, me on rhythm guitar and one on bass and Jacob on mandolin, and like building the sound of a song in that way. We stripped it all back and built it back with like piece by piece, very minimally. And it has this really spacious soundscape that really suits the song in a cool way.
Mm.
One that's seen a lot of lives on stage too.
Yeah.
That one we kind of took it to school several different times and found different resonation, different resonance within it each time.
Mm-hmm. Are there certain songs where you find yourself doing that, like this one, like where you're revisiting it constantly?
Totally. Yeah. Like on the live album, we played recordings. We played versions of the songs totally different from the recordings, which I love. Mm-hmm. And that song, Big Star, is a great example too, because most recently we've been playing it on stage around a single microphone, fully acoustically. Whereas on the record, it's kind of our most out there, spacious, exploratory, sonic thing.
Yeah.
And it kind of made it fresh and brand new for us again.
Mm. That must be energizing to approach songs like that.
Definitely.
Yeah. And I think it's a test of a song. Mm-hmm. I think if a song can't withstand that kind of focus or that kind of deliberate intimacy, mm-hmm. then it maybe doesn't have enough meat on the bones.
Mm. And Louise.
I know it well.
Yeah, I bet.
I remember very specifically when Joseph brought Louise to the band, and it was maybe like the most fully formed and you sounding thing yet at that point. And I still feel like it's very you. You've changed so much in the year since, but you still inhabit that song and that type of storytelling, I think, equally to that first moment.
In what ways do you think it's him, or did you think it was him?
Joseph has a unique ability to zoom out, but to still show the most microscopic detail. Mm-hmm. And that song, both in its the detail of its writing and the scope of its storytelling, does those things.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jacob.
And Green Jesus.
Green Jesus. You know, over the pandemic, I got into gardening.
Yeah.
And I grew some marijuana.
That's tough, isn't it? I heard it's hard.
You know, I found it a lot easier than tomatoes.
Ah, okay.
But as a part of my experience, kind of reconnecting with things that grow,
mm-hmm.
we'd spent 10 years traveling so much that I didn't anymore have a sense of the seasons.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a really profound experience to be like, oh, this is spring starting.
Mm.
Oh, there's strawberries. Oh, there's honeysuckle. That's that smell.
Yep.
And really the song is about finding so much little beautiful love and meaning in things that require patient attention to grow.
Yeah.
And there's a bit of a, you know, wink and a nod to it, but I think it's about something more than that too.
Yeah, about the environment around us and how we should care for it.
Absolutely.
My burden with me.
My burden with me. What record is that on?
Coming Down the Mountain.
Filmed in Durham or recorded in Durham.
Mm.
My burden with me, you know, now we have enough perspective on our music to look back with different ideas that from how we understand it, not how we want it to be understood. And I think one of the things that we've been talking about lately is that there's songs that are meant to be shared,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily like campfire songs, but they feel within some of the folk canon that we learned about song craft from. And I think My Burden With Me is one of the best examples of that.
Oh,
that's a song that I think you can imagine. Well, it's hard for me not to hear it with Libby's voice, but I can imagine anyone singing that song and it being their song too.
Wow. That must be a really powerful thing to go out and do that song all the time, but also hopefully see other people do it, right? Like to put that out into the world and see that come back in a way.
I think that's one of the most like special, you know, it's hard not to get into like Hallmark language. It's one of the rewarding versions of whatever. When we see like YouTube versions of our own songs played by somebody in Germany, it's so cool. Yeah. And then like the Carolina UNC has a bluegrass program now. And they put a couple of different Mipso songs at their like final yearly recital.
Oh my gosh.
And the director told me that we're one of the bands people tell him that turned them on to like roots from acoustic music the mm-hmm. most. That's the coolest thing.
Yeah. That must be a real full circle moment for you.
For sure.
Yeah.
And I think it's a good reminder of like the point of what we're doing is not to like put your ego out there and stand on stage and be in the spotlight, but to carry something forward and share it with people.
Yeah. And you're part of something larger than yourself, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. What about Couple Acres Greener?
Sort of just what we mentioned. Yeah. A Couple Acres Greener is a, It's sort of, it's funny now to think about that, a song written by a 21-year-old me that's so sort of like full of like angst and a sense that like, you know, it's I'm a little bit embarrassed at some of the like angstiness of it.
Oh, really?
But I appreciate the sort of sentiment of.
But angst, that era of angst is timeless.
It was honest.
We all have it.
Yeah.
And it's actually funny on the release tour that Gas in the Tank came from, we started to see kind of a new generation of fans at our shows. Mm-hmm. And often afterwards, if we saw them at the merch table, we'd engage like, how are you here? And it's because they were finding that first record, mm-hmm. which was not the thing that was being promoted. It's not like what our label partners were telling us to do on Instagram Reels to get attention. It's like, it was just what they were finding. And it's what we found meaningful in that time in our life, they were finding meaningful in that time of theirs.
Right.
And so that's what a song's for.
It's really cool to hear y'all say that because we had a very similar conversation with Superchunk, who has put out this music, right? And they're seeing, you know, a much younger group of folks come and listen and like sing the songs back to them. And it's one of those things where it's like the time, like for people, like some songs just fit where you are in life, right?
Totally.
And that can go for generations.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But to Joe's point, it is kind of trippy when you're out of that time of life.
Yeah, I bet.
It makes you reevaluate, you know, who you are now and who you were then. And
yeah.
And also sometimes we see those people in the crowd and we're like, how did you get here?
Yeah.
Like, who?
Did your mom drop you off?
Yeah, who brought you here?
Which is pretty cool. If your mom dropped you off to go to the Mipso show, you're doing good.
Thank you, Mom.
Yeah. And When I'm Gone.
When I'm Gone, from the same era, that song, it makes me think so much about the studio we recorded it in, the Rubber Room in Chapel Hill. And another big mentor of ours, especially you, Joe, Jerry Brown.
Yeah.
Great steward of the acoustic music community and an amazing encourager and mentor to many, many bands and songwriters over the years. I don't think we would have as rich a musical community here without people like Jerry and spaces like the Rubber Room. Mm. And I think about that song very visually from what the studio looks like and how the light and everything informed, I think, where that recording went.
Yeah. Very sense of place there as well with that, right?
Definitely.
That's the end of the set list. But for this portion of our chat, I kind of want to just open it up to the both of you. And if there's anything that you would like to say or talk to that we may have not talked about yet.
Well, I think one other thing that I've been thinking about yesterday and today being here and with all of you helping to make this possible is that a part of what makes like being shaped by sound, it's not just the music, it's the like the infrastructure of the community. And one thing I feel really lucky about being a North Carolinian and someone who makes music strongly associated with North Carolina is that I think the part of the reason we have such a great scene is because of the myriad of things that surround it. The independent record label, like this record was pressed at a vinyl press in Raleigh.
Right.
There's so many great labels and managers and there's so many venues. We're playing the Cat's Cradle this weekend two times. And I think it's the 9th and 10th time we're playing the Main Room and we've played countless other things there too. And I remember so distinctly sending Frank Heath an email as little head students being like, can we play our dream? Can you make our dream come true? Can we come play? And he said yes and gave us a Friday night and we couldn't believe it.
Right.
We promptly freaked out because we didn't know how we were going to pull it off, you know, 3 months later. But it takes a real village to lift music up, and increasingly in the connected, but to me, emotionally disconnected world that we all live in via our phone, I think that's going to become even more important. So I just feel when we got the call about being here, I was so thankful that it was being made and so proud to be a part of the community. Mm.
Well, thank you all for being here. It's truly an honor to have you all in here and chat with us and play these songs. It's we were equally as excited when we heard you all were coming in. So thank you so much. And we really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks, you.
Thanks. Awesome. And thanks to the whole crew that made this thing possible.
Yes, absolutely. Thanks for joining us on the Shaped by Sound podcast. If you'd like to hear some of the songs we discussed today, you can find them on our website at pbsnc.org/shapedbysound. Or find us on the PBS North Carolina YouTube page. Thanks for listening.